On this episode of The Playbook, I have Jim Estill, CEO of Danby Appliances and Shipper B, and we talk about how to create a side hustle and turn it into a multi-million dollar business by failing often, failing fast, and failing cheap. Join me for all of this and more on The Playbook. This is Entrepreneurs The Playbook, where each week I bring you some of the greatest athletes, celebrities, and entrepreneurs to talk about their personal and professional playbook to success and what made them champions on the field and in the boardroom. I'm your host, David Meltzer.
This is Dave Meltzer with Entrepreneurs The Playbook, and I have CEO Jim Estill here with me, and he is CEO of Danby Appliances and Shipper B. So I got to start there because I had to ask the guys, I'm like, how's he a CEO of two different companies?
Well, Shipper B was a startup that we incubated at Danby Appliances, but it's in fundamentally a different business. Shipper B is a courier company. Danby Appliances is an appliance company. And I'm an entrepreneur. Danby is kind of like smokestack and kind of running. And so I have to start something new. And not only that, I'm an environmentalist, and Shipper B saves 73% of the greenhouse gas per parcel shipped, so it can sort of be my environmental legacy as well.
Now, I have a lot of people that I coach as entrepreneurs, and I tell them to create businesses within their business. Is that what Shipper B was? Was it the logistics side of Danby?
No, it was not. Danby manufactures about 2 million appliances a year, so part of the Shipper B needs an appliance. We have this transfer mailbox. We call it a hive. So yes, Danby manufactures that, but it was not really a division. It was an idea that was hatched, and we started it at Danby. And then, of course, after they ended up with 35 people or whatever, they just were taking too many parking spots, so we had to move them into their own building.
Now, you are a serial entrepreneur, and you and I have been involved actually in some of the same businesses with RIM over the years. I was CEO of a thing called the PCE phone way back when in 99, the first smartphone in the world, and worked closely in the 957 era of the RIM pager, and moved forward in all types of convergence devices. We're old enough to know that's what they used to call them before they called them smartphones. But this idea of having, side hustles as an entrepreneur, they've been around, and yet it's more trendy today that everybody, that's a lawyer, a doctor, an engineer, and I don't know if it's an aspect of the internet or what truly is motivating it. I have more people come to me about side hustles, as they call them, compared to actual, substantial businesses that grow with an executive summary and business plan and funding. How do you distinguish between a side hustle and an actual business?
Well, I mean, if you're talking Danby and Shipper B, Shipper B becomes not a side hustle when you're getting into the millions of dollars. And it is in the millions of dollars. So we raised $19 million US, launched, and it became a real company. I guess and my wife always says, my problem is when I do things, I don't do them small. So I always tend to do.
I love something. That. I should marry you. I'm a big thinker. That's great.
Right. So whenever I do things, I do them too big. And so that's how my side hustles become real businesses. And I've done this for my whole career. So when I was doing BlackBerry, I was not working at BlackBerry. I invested, was an advisor, sat on the board, but I was running my own computer business. So I was doing my computer business, that was one of the things. And I was on a number of boards and doing advisory work and stuff like that. So I always juggle multiple balls.
And how, we distinguish this quantum memory that we have, an instinct that was born into us. And I have a saying about true entrepreneurs, and you are, Canada's 40 under 40, your whole career, you've been successful and learned lessons as well along the way. But what do you think it is in the spirit of entrepreneurship, and when did you recognize it in your own being that, there's some, while you're in school or some way along the line, you realize I have a different genetic code?
Well, you see, when you're a kid, then everyone thinks, oh, this kid is different, and that's a bad thing because you want to be like everyone else. And then at some point, And this actually doesn't even happen when you graduate. Although now being a startup guy is more trendy, but when I started, it wasn't trendy at all.
We got cool too late as entrepreneurs, right?
Exactly. But then sometime after you're in business for 10 years or 5 years, and all of a sudden, wow, this guy's the CEO and this guy has the real, then all of a sudden it becomes cool. So I became cool 20 years after I was out of university.
Yeah, me too. People want my selfies and my autographs. I tell my wife, I'm like, why wasn't it cool to be an entrepreneur when I was in my 20s? Right? Nobody would. I was just kind of a weirdo, crazy. You know, everyone laughed at me. Like, he works in the internet. You know, he's one of those dorky guys. Now, can I have your autograph?
Well, and I think our education system also rewards conformity. And I am an entrepreneur, which by definition means I kind of don't conform. So you're not actually getting the accolades for doing the academic school stuff because you challenge things. Well, professor said that. Well, that doesn't mean it's right. Oh, that's the way that other people do it. That's not the way I do it. I'll do it my own way and whatnot. And I think part of the entrepreneurship is, for me, I do like to run my own boss. I have a daughter who went into the Navy. And I said, you know, I wouldn't mind joining the Navy. How can I join as an admiral? Like,
that's awesome. I wish I could. That'd be interesting. but we are a breed that's born differently. And yet there's a bunch of people that are conformists that, you know, they go through formal education, but yet they're very attracted to starting their own business. And I try to explain to a lot of people that it's, you know, just like going to med school isn't built for everyone. You know, being an entrepreneur is not for everyone. It does take certain personality traits. What personality traits or characteristics do you think best suit an entrepreneur?
Well, one thing that I was fortunate, I had high energy and high drive. I think those things are perfect for entrepreneurs. Entrepreneurs also can't care too much about what other people think. So it's like basically doing it your way, even though people tell you, oh, that will never work. As a matter of fact, that actually gives me power. If you tell me that my idea is a stupid idea, I'm going to prove to you that it's not a stupid idea. Now, I've also, as I've gained wisdom, which I gained from experience, I've learned also to celebrate failure. So I say fail often, fail fast, fail cheap. Having a failure does not make you a failure. And everyone who I know who is a success usually has a few failures along the way. But it's fail often, fail fast, fail cheap. So if I do have a failure, it's like you don't go bankrupt. You lose something that's in your affordability, right?
I needed you as a mentor because I failed often and fast, but I felt really expensive with over $100 million loss in bankruptcy in 2008. So I needed your wisdom back then. Wow, I agree with you. I fail fast and cheap all the time, and I love it. It's interesting now that we're in this next crisis. You know, it's 97 we lived through, both of us, 2001, 2008, now in 2020. I told my wife I screwed up in 2008 because I was prepared for it. I knew it was coming, and I ended up getting my ego in the way and overextending myself, not asking for help, getting into lawsuits that really interfered with my plan on taking advantage of 2008. But this is the first time I'm 52 years old, and this happened. And, you know, I'm here to help people stabilize what they're doing, but there's also an extraordinary amount of opportunity because I was prepared and built 13 years of wisdom for this opportunity that exists to help people and to also make more money from it to help more people later on. Do you have a certain philosophy towards money itself? You've been so successful in these ventures, you're able to raise money, make money, but what is your philosophy with money, happiness, motivation, inspiration?
So I have the most counterculture, probably entrepreneurial way of thinking about money. And that is, you want to have so much money, enough for security, safety, old age, but you also want, but everything above that, that's just paper. So I have always given away everything above that. But then, of course, being an entrepreneur, then I get into a new venture and all of a sudden it needs cash. So I shouldn't have given away so much, but I also am counterculture even in what I spend, how I spend. And it's one thing in YPO, you're surrounding yourself with a lot of people that spend a lot of money, and I am my own person, and it drives everybody crazy. Jim, how come you don't have 5 houses? How come you don't have, you know, that must be your winter car? No, that's my car. It's not a winter car. So
it's a huge compliment when people go, that cannot be David Meltzer's car. And I love it. Right? My kids won't even drive my car. I use it as punishment. I go, if you're not good, you have to drive the Volt.
That's perfect. Well, the other thing I always say is I can park my car anywhere. No one's breaking into it. I have friends. They have cars. You can't park in half the places. Well, no, I'll go anywhere. I can leave the thing unlocked. Nobody's going to go into it. They're not going to think there's anything there.
Yeah. It's funny. Ed Milet's a friend of mine. He's an entrepreneur and a motivational guy. But he has the private planes and the Rolls Royces, and he doesn't apologize for being rich at all. And he's philanthropic as well. But he came over to the office driving his Rolls Royce, and he was so upset because someone dinged it. And I was like, yeah, that's $1,200.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, I'll just be able to reach in and push it out. That'll be good.
Yeah, well, both of us are compassionate capitalists. Both of us big fans of YPO and mentoring other people. And you have done just an extraordinary job of allowing wealth to come through you for others. What motivates you, and how do you decide where to put that extra paper to help other people?
Well, I try to put it where it will make a difference, and I tend to put it in places which are somewhat entrepreneurial. I tend to like charities that are helping base needs, homelessness, and stuff like that. I don't tend to help the arts much and stuff like that. That's just who I am.
You don't solve rich people problems.
Exactly. That's exactly right. But at the end of the day, I don't like people to judge how other people spend their charitable money. So if you choose to spend yours on the homeless shelter and I choose to spend mine on the hospice, high five to both of us. Like, it's all good. It's not that, you know, you have to do hospice because I chose hospice and you have to do the hospital because I did the hospital. So I try to solve problems that I can. And in some cases, I try to do it entrepreneurially as well.
And, you know, I sit on as a chief chancellor of Junior Achievement University worldwide. I sit and have the Crescent Moon Foundation, where we give scholarships to kids here in the U.S. And then also the chairman of Unstoppable, which is mostly in Kenya and the Pagani, building villages and community centers and schools. A lot of people don't understand why I would give my paper outside of the United States when we have so many different issues. I know you also donate money worldwide. Is there a strategy or philosophy that you have, besides no judgments or conditions on where others spend their money, in your heart, you know, how do you see the whole world connected, more than just our country being isolated from all the rest of the world?
Well, I'm just lucky for where I was born and where I live, and I recognize that. One of the secrets of happiness, actually, is gratitude. So I'm grateful for what I have and where I live and the safety that I live in and whatnot. So little money can go so far in some highly impoverished places that it's unbelievable. Like, I could give you $2 and you can't buy even a coffee for that. You can give someone $2 in some countries, and that's a meal for the day. That's for the family. I mean, like, I love making an impact in that way. That said, I do give a lot to the community, and I believe that having a little more equality makes a community safer. And so I like having a mixed. I'm not one that says, oh, all the, you know, 0.1% have to have all the wealth and everybody else has to starve. I actually think as YPOers, one of our problems is we need to have it a little more level, because it's not safe for us to say, oh, we're going to live in our ivory tower with our guards and our razor wire and whatnot. I'm sure you've traveled to places where that's the way it is. You go to Brazil, you go to Mexico, even, you have to be in
Mumbai, right. The CEO of Reliance, he has a high rise of 52 stories for his family right next to the slums.
Right. And you have to have your guards and your security systems. That's not a good way to live. in my opinion, I much more have a North American view where if you work hard, you should be able to make a living and live a reasonably decent life. If you work hard doing anything, whether that's digging ditches or doing construction or serving tables or doing dishes, if you work, you should be able to make a living is my opinion.
Sure. And speaking of that, you know, there's, I think, 28,000 YPOers, existing, you know, young professionals out there that now are faced with some serious challenges because we want them to stay in business because those are the ones that are driving the world. You know, these young professionals are the ones who are affording people for all those different positions that you described that they can't afford, you know, their first home and to have children and healthcare and a variety and food. And now with the question marks that exist from this new issue that we've never seen before, I'm calling upon the YPOers and the executive YPOers like yourself to give advice that through your experience and wisdom will help not only the other young professionals, but also the people that are doing the work, the people that are executing on your plan. What advice would you give in these types of times that we're living in?
So I look at things as, some things are conditions. They're just things that happen. And I can't change the condition. I can change my reaction to that condition. And I'm old, so I've lived through 1987 stock crash. I've lived through 9/11. I've lived through 2008. So I've lived through this, and I know that things get better. And it doesn't get better if we go and cry in our bedrooms and say that, you know, and put our head in the sand. My other experience is right now I am all about making my staff know that I've got their back, and I've sent emails, I've communicated, I said I'm going to try to make sure that you all get paid and that everything here does it. And what that means is they all have my back because they know that I'm looking out after them. So right now, this is not a month where we're saying, oh, we have to make the most profit. We have to save the sky from falling because this COVID-19, nobody's traveling. And Danby makes bar fridges. We have a huge market share in hotels. And are they is Marriott going to be building more hotels? Not anytime soon. Now, they're going to finish out the next 6 months on the ones that they're in the middle of, but they're not building new ones. I also believe in every challenge, there's opportunity. So we're going to lose the hotel business. I get that. There will be no hotels built for a year, but people will cocoon. So you're going to say, oh, I'm going to stay at home and I'm not going to go out to eat. And oh, I need another bar fridge at home. I better have a wine cooler at home. So, and freezers were almost sold out on for the same reason. Everyone is stockpiling and whatnot. So there's in change,
you always turn
there's opportunity.
Into a toilet paper holder as well.
And exactly.
God knows the overwhelming amount of toilet paper that's going to be left over at these houses. So just, you know, I'm an entrepreneur like you. We're always thinking this is great. Last thing though, you know, one of the things you said is that you have the experience of knowing things get better, but we also have the experience of knowing not only do things get better, but if I look back even on my bankruptcy where I lost over $100 million, that I just got stronger, right? Like these
good
things, right? These things make us stronger. These are the experiences that make us who we are. This is what makes you you. And I want the young people that work for me not only to have the stability, and that's the first meeting I had is, look, I plan for this. You're not going to lose your job. You're going to see your friends. They're going to be late. This is before even the rush came this week. This is last week. I said, you watch. Your friends are going to be laid off. Their businesses are going to be closed. People, they haven't planned for this. And I want you to know that I really appreciate you building my business the way you have. And here we are. But how do you really convey, you know, we can't convey what marriage is like, what having kids is like, and, you know, what getting old is like. But I think we can convey what getting stronger is like through challenges to them. What's your best piece of advice as far as conveying that to finish up the interview?
Well, the best way to make people calmer, and we need some of the calm in the world because the sky is not falling. My community has no cases and whatnot. And yet they're saying, oh, we're going to shut all the restaurants and everything. But the way to make people calm is by over communicating. So we're totally over communicating. And because we're anybody who can work at home, we're sending home. Except I've got factories. You can't exactly assemble a product at home, and you can't drive a forklift at home. But so I've got some people have to work here. But I'm sending everybody home. One of the things I'm a big advocate is video. So we have to make it so that instead of wandering into your office, I wander into your video and Skype or whatever I do, call bridge, whatever, right?
That is awesome, because you are the very first video playbook they've ever allowed me to do, especially with Entrepreneur. And I think we're starting with the bar extremely high. I can't wait to meet you in person once this interference gets out of our way. I'm coming up to Canada quite a bit, so I'd love to see you and really sit down and learn about your expertise and wisdom. And I'm sure all the entrepreneurs listening to this appreciate your guidance as well. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you, David.
You're amazing. This is Jim Estill. He is the CEO of both Danby Appliance and ShipperBee, but most importantly, he is a serially successful entrepreneur. Very few of those. Learn the lessons here. Join me and Jim here on The Playbook.
Hey, podcast listeners. Thank you for listening, as always, to today's episode. I know you've been enjoying the Road to Revenue episodes. They are downloading at record paces, and I am so grateful for you joining me, not only on the podcast, but live every Friday at 11 a.m. Pacific time, 2 p.m. Eastern. Make sure you email me at david@dmeltzer.com or text me at 949-298-2905. Thank you so much.